Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Noam Chomsky returns with some little-known facts and sane suggestions. He talks on the trumped-up crises in North Korea and Iran and the real disaster of Syria. I hope you'll stay tuned. Noam Chomsky spoke at length on April 24, 2017, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Amy Goodman played the role of interviewer. Goodman is a very good interviewer, and one of her several interviewing skills is knowing when not to interrupt and just let the guy talk. Which is pretty much all the time when the guy talking is Noam Chomsky. Ask Chomsky a question about public affairs, and he will respond with a long, brilliant, complex, impeccably organized, and pretty persuasive mini-lecture, topped with occasional splashes of dry, ironic humor, delivered absolutely deadpan. You have to listen carefully to get the deadpan irony, but you should be listening carefully in any case. We heard a bit of Chomsky's talk on last week's show, when he explained why the Republican Party is the most dangerous organization in the history of the world. Strong words, but he made a pretty good case. And of course, he was talking about climate change. Today, Chomsky talks about the trumped-up foreign crises in North Korea and Iran, and the real foreign disaster in Syria. Let's start with North Korea. This part is full of facts that at least I hadn't heard before. For example, the several times North Korea has agreed to dismantle its atomic bomb program, only to have the United States sabotage the agreement afterwards. Probably you didn't know much about the massive, serious war crimes the U.S. committed in North Korea during the Korean War, either. Betcha the History Channel didn't have a special on that. One of the great things about a Chomsky talk is that it's full of specific facts that are publicly available, but that somehow nobody else ever seemed to mention. Let's get on to the talk today. Amy Goodman asks if Trump's very aggressive stance against North Korea and Iran was taken mainly to boost his sagging popularity at home.
General McMaster, the National Security Advisor, saying tensions with North Korea are coming to a head. Do you think there is a possibility that the U.S. would attack North Korea?
This administration is extremely unpredictable. Trump probably has no idea what he's going to do 5 minutes from now. So you can't really make predictions with much confidence, but I doubt it very much. The reason is very simple. An attack on North Korea would unleash, no matter what attack it is, even a nuclear attack, would unleash massive artillery bombardment of Seoul, which is the biggest city in South Korea right near the border, which would wipe it out, including plenty of American troops. I'm no technical expert, but as I read and can see, there's no defense against that. Furthermore, North Korea could retaliate against American bases in the region where there's plenty of American soldiers and so on, also in Japan. They'd be devastated. North Korea would be finished, you know, so would much of the region. But if attacked, presumably they would respond, very likely. In fact, the responses might be automatic. McMaster, at least, and Mattis understand this, how much influence they have, we don't know. So I think an attack is unlikely. But the real question is there a way of dealing with the problem? There are a lot of proposals, sanctions, a new missile defense system, which is a major threat to China, will increase tensions there, military threats of various kinds, sending an aircraft carrier, the Vinson, to North Korea, except by accident. It happened to be going in the opposite direction, but we'll forget that. But these are, those are the proposals, that kind of proposals as to how to solve it. Actually, there's one proposal that's ignored. I mean, you see a mention of it now and then. It's a pretty simple proposal. Remember, the goal is to get North Korea to freeze its weapons and missile systems. So one proposal is to accept their offer to do that. Sounds simple. They've made a proposal, China and North Korea, propose to freeze the North Korean missile and nuclear weapon systems, and the U.S. instantly rejected it. And you can't blame that on Trump. Obama did the same thing a couple of years ago. Same offer was presented, I think it was 2015. The Obama administration instantly rejected it. And the reason is that it calls for a quid pro quo. It says, in return, the United States should put an end to threatening military maneuvers on North Korea's borders, which happened to include, under Trump, sending of nuclear-capable B-52s flying right near the border. Now, maybe Americans don't remember very well, but North Koreans have a memory of not too long ago when North Korea was absolutely flattened, literally, by American bombing. There was literally no targets left. And I really urge people who haven't done it to read the official American military histories, the Air Quarterly Review, the military histories describing this. They describe it very vividly and accurately. They say there just weren't any targets left. So what could we do? Well, we decided to attack the dams, the huge dams. That's a major war crime. People were hanged for it at Nuremberg, but put that aside. And then comes an ecstatic, gleeful description of the bombing of the dams and the huge flow of water, which was wiping out valleys and destroying the rice crop on which Asians depend for survival. Lots of racist comment. But all with exultation and glee. You really have to read it to appreciate it. The North Koreans don't have to bother reading it. They lived it. So when nuclear-capable B-52s are flying on their border, along with other threatening military maneuvers, they're kind of upset about it. Strange people. And they continue to develop what they see as a potential deterrent that might protect the regime from, and the country, in fact, from destruction. This has nothing at all to do with what you think about the government. So maybe it's the worst government in human history. Okay. But these are still the facts that exist. So why is the United States unwilling to accept an agreement which would end the immediate threats of destruction against North Korea and in return freeze the weapons and missile systems? Well, I leave that to you, and remember that's bipartisan in this case. The usual argument is, well, you can't trust them, and so on and so forth. But there is a history, and there's no time to run through the history. It's quite interesting. It begins in 1993 when under Clinton, the North Koreans made a deal with Israel to terminate North Korean missile shipments to the Middle East, which is a great, serious threat to Israel and the world. And in return, Israel would recognize North Korea. The Clinton administration wouldn't accept that. They pressured Israel, which has to do with they're told, to withdraw from it. And North Korea responded by firing their first intermediate-range missiles. I won't go on with the rest. It's a very interesting story. There was actually an agreement in 2005 that North Korea would completely dismantle its nuclear weapons and missile systems, end them, finish, dismantle them, in return for a non-aggression pact from the United States, an end to threats, provision by the West, that means by the United States, of a light water reactor which can't produce nuclear weapons, but could produce, be used for peaceful purposes, research, medical, other purposes. And that was basically the agreement, 2005. Didn't last very long. The Bush administration instantly undermined it. It dismantled the consortium that was supposed to provide the reactor, and it immediately imposed pressure, and it, when the U.S. pressures, it means it happens, banks to block North Korean financial transactions, including perfectly legitimate trade. So the crazy North Koreans started producing missiles and nuclear weapons again. And that's been the kind of record all the way through. So, yeah, maybe the most horrible regime in human history, but the fact of the matter is the regime does want to survive, and it even wants to carry out economic development. There's pretty general agreement about this, which it cannot do at any significant way when it's pouring resources, very scarce resources, into weapons and missile production. So they have considerable incentive, including survival, to perhaps continue this process of reacting in a kind of tit-for-tat fashion to U.S. actions. When the U.S. lowers tensions, they do. When we raise tensions, they go on with these plans. How about that as a possibility? I mean, it is, if you look at the press, it's occasionally mentioned. Actually, it was not a bad article in the Washington Post about it recently by a U.S. professor who teaches in South Korea. So occasionally it's this strange possibility of letting the North Koreans do exactly what we want them to do. Sometimes this is mentioned, but it's pretty much dismissed. We can't do that sort of thing. There are similar questions to raise about Iran. So Iran is, you know, the adults in the room, like Mattis and so on, say it's the greatest threat to peace, you know, the greatest sponsor of terrorism, on and on. How is it a sponsor of terrorism? Well, could go through that. So, for example, in Yemen, it's claimed that they are providing some aid to rebel tribesmen, Houthi tribesmen. Okay, maybe they are. What is the United States doing in Yemen? It's providing a huge flood of arms to its Saudi Arabian ally who are destroying the country, who've created a huge humanitarian crisis. Huge numbers of people killed, massive starvation, but Iran is the major source of terrorism. And if you look around the world, there's many questions like this. I don't want to go on too long, but there's one lesson that you discover when you carefully look at the historical record. And what I just described about North Korea is pretty typical. Over and over again, there are possibilities of diplomacy and negotiation which might not succeed. You can't be sure if you don't try them, but which look pretty promising, which are abandoned, dismissed, literally without comment, in favor of increased force and violence. In fact, that's also the background for the 1953 moment when the clock moved to 2 minutes to midnight and the U.S. faced the first serious threat to its security since probably the War of 1812, could have been avoided. There's pretty good evidence that it could have been avoided, but it was the possibility was literally not even considered. And case after case is like this. It's worth looking at the historical record from that perspective to ask whether that general comment has some validity. I think if you do, you'll find that it has considerable merit.
We are listening to Noam Chomsky in a public talk in Cambridge on April 24, responding to questions from Amy Goodman. We now turn to the poison gas attack by somebody in Syria and the U.S.'s immediate response, firing off 59 Tomahawk missiles. What to make of this bloody situation? Back to Noam Chomsky.
I last interviewed you on April 4th, just a few weeks ago on Democracy Now! It was the 50th anniversary of Dr. King giving his Beyond Vietnam speech, Why I Oppose the War in Vietnam, where he called the U.S. the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. And I wanted to turn from North Korea and Iran to Syria. It was the day of the gas attack in Syria, so we didn't get to talk about it very much. And I'm wondering your thoughts on what you think happened and then the ensuing U.S. bombing that President Trump would later talk about, saying he was having chocolate cake with the Chinese president, very, very good chocolate cake, when they launched the Tomahawk missiles into Iraq, he said, and he was corrected by the interviewer, right, who said it was actually
Bunch
Syria.
Of ragheads, it's all about the same. But, well, there are some things we know for sure. There was a serious chemical weapons attack. Nobody doubts that. It's plausible that it was the Syrian government, which does raise some questions. It's not so obvious why the Assad regime would have carried out a chemical warfare attack at a moment when it's pretty much winning the war. And the worst danger it faces is that a counter force will enter to undermine its progress. So it does raise some questions. Even though maybe you can think up some reason why the Assad regime, which is a murderous, brutal regime, might have done it. There's even another question as to why the Russians would have allowed it. Remember, this is the air base is a joint Russian-Syrian base. Russia has plenty of clout in Syria. And for them, it's a total disaster. Now, they have global concerns, not just local concerns in Syria. The White House did put out a justification, an intelligence report to explain and account for showing why they had absolute confidence that it was a Syrian government attack. Now, this was analyzed closely by a very serious and credible analyst, Theodore Postol, professor at MIT, who has a long record of highly successful, credible analysis. He's a highly regarded strategic analyst and intelligence analyst. And he gave a pretty devastating critique of the White House report. You can pick it up online and take a look at it. So there certainly are some questions that Syria is capable of a monstrous act like that, the Syrian government, that much is not in doubt. But one question that arises is, before doing something, could you find out what happened? Okay? Let's have an inquiry, take a look and see what in fact actually happened. Now, there are plenty of cases where it looked as though things happened, but they didn't. And remember that reporting from Syria is extremely difficult. If reporters go into the rebel-held areas and don't do what they're told, get your head cut off. Patrick Coburn and others have written about this. You just can't seriously report from those areas. There are obvious questions when you're reporting from the government side. So the reporters there are very good reporters doing a serious, courageous job, but there's not much you can do. So we just don't know a lot. Those are the circumstances in which the 59 Tomahawk missiles were launched. That's pretty easy. It's easy to sit in Washington and push a button and say, go kill somebody. That's considered courage, man, macho, showing how strong we are. What did they actually do? Well, apparently the Tomahawk missiles were targeting a part of the airfield that doesn't seem to be used. And in fact, the next day, planes were taking off. And in fact, the village that was attacked by the chemical weapons has been even more heavily attacked by straight bombing from the Assad government after the 59 Tomahawk missiles. So whatever they were intended to do doesn't seem to have anything to do with Syria. I suspect that what they were intended to do was pretty much what you described, to shore up Trump's image, as I think it was Nikki Haley at the UN said, there's a new sheriff in town. So now we've got Wyatt Earp, you know, pulling out his gun and getting rid of the bad guys, no more of this soft stuff. So it was probably an attempt to shore up that image, pretty much like the bomb in Afghanistan. Nobody knows what it was for, what it had to do with. Probably destroyed a large part of Afghanistan. Shortly after that, there was an incredibly brutal and successful Taliban attack, which killed a couple hundred recruits, most of them unarmed, young draftees, didn't know what they were doing. It was so bad that the defense minister resigned. Doesn't seem to have any effect on. It was supposedly aimed at ISIS. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. They don't seem to be affected by it. There doesn't seem to be any strategic analysis behind any of these actions, as far as anyone can tell. They seem like kind of about at the level of the Twitters that keep coming out. Something that kind of occurs to me, so why not do it? It's cheap. It may kill a lot of people. It makes me look good. You know, makes it seem as if I'm defending the country and so on. It's hard to see it as anything but that. That these things help the people of Syria and Iraq is very hard to imagine.
What do you think has to be done to solve the crisis, the humanitarian catastrophe?
In Syria? It's a terrible catastrophe. And, you know, unfortunately, there isn't a lot that can be done about it. There are some things that can be done. I mean, the idea that you can send in the Marines and bomb and so on, that has a small problem. If you do, you probably set off a nuclear war. And not only is Syria destroyed, the rest of Syria, but the rest of the world too. So there's a little difficulty in that scenario, whatever one thinks about the justification for it. So what can be done? Well, one thing that can be done, which is really easy, very easy, is to take care of the people fleeing from this disaster. I mean, there are huge numbers of people fleeing from the disaster. What do we do about them? Make sure they don't come here, you know, kind of like people fleeing from, you know, my relatives, in fact, trying to flee from Eastern Europe and before when the Nazis were coming along. Not, we don't want them, not here, you know. So the Syrians don't come, maybe a tiny trickle, but very few come here. Europe's not that much better, in fact, pretty horrible too. So one thing you could do is just take care of the people who are fleeing the disaster. Another thing you can do is provide humanitarian aid for those in the region. Now, there are countries who are absorbing refugees, remember. Like take Lebanon. It's not a rich country like us, poor country. About 40% of the population are refugees, many of them fleeing from the Israeli wars as far back as 48. A huge number of Syrians. Jordan, another poor country, has absorbed a huge number of refugees. Turkey has a couple of million. Iran has accepted refugees. There are poor countries that are accommodating refugees, but not the rich countries. The rich countries, it's not our business, certainly not us. So another thing you do is provide badly needed aid and assistance for those who have succeeded in fleeing the disaster or who remain in parts of Syria where survival is possible but are living under horrible conditions. Now, that's all cheap and easy. Tiny fraction of increasing the military budget to cause more destruction. Now, the other thing that can be done and is being done is to try to support local efforts throughout Syria at local ceasefires just to lower the level of violence. Now, that's happening in different places. Yeah, maybe the people don't like each other, but people sometimes like to survive. And there are accommodations worked out, and they could be helped. A broader possibility is to try to pursue negotiations that will lead to some kind of diplomatic settlement. Now, there have been efforts, but they're mixed. And they're probably, we can't be certain, but there seem to be possibilities that were dismissed. There are things that could be done, not what we would like to see. You know, it'd be nice to see here's a solution that'll make everybody happy. and the destruction. But those just don't seem on the possible agenda because for all kind of reasons, including the threat of very serious war if Russia and the United States don't act in a high level of concert in pursuing whatever they may be doing.
Noam Chomsky, speaking in Cambridge, Massachusetts, on April 24, 2017. Thanks again to Boston's Chuck Rosina, who recorded the talk and made it available to us. And thank you again for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Find a free archive of our shows at our website, which remains newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, that's me, myself, and our human relations manager, Bill O'Reilly. On behalf of our entire staff, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimate non carborundum. War is not healthy for children and other living things. Try to live each day as though the truth were true, and please come back again next week. Ciao.